It's Tuesday, May 14th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And Trump, former fixer, or as he says, former fixer, Michael Cohen, was on the stand in a courthouse in Manhattan today. You know, most fixers are technically fixes because they work for such organizations as the Trump Organization or the Bonanno Crime Family. Please, crime family is such an ugly term. We call them decarceration enthusiasts. So there Cohen is talking about his time trying to hush up a Playboy model or being irate at being passed over for a White House job. Yeah, blow to the ego, he said. Trump calling him on vacation to assure him that thing is getting taken care of. Trump stiffing him on his bonus. And we know all this by the drip by drip, you might say drip by drab updates. It reminds me of the late 80s. A championship fight was on pay-per-view, but your dad wouldn't pay per the view. So what could you do? As they said on The Simpsons, Carl and Lenny talking about the big fight coming up. Yeah, you want to come over my house and listen to round-by-round updates on the radio? Oh yeah, okay. And then after the fight, we can watch the still photos on the 11 o'clock news. Not too shabby. So there I am. And I should be really appalled and ensorcelled and just fixed on the former fixer. But it is the information on Trump himself that really captivates me. In the New York Times written rundown, Jonathan Swan reporting from inside the courthouse, Trump's eyes are closed and he appears to be sleeping, as he has through most of the trial. And then a little bit later, Trump, who had been sleeping, wakes up, leans over, taps his lawyer, Todd Blanche, and whispers something in his ear. Okay. And then, Jonathan Swan, reporting from inside the courthouse, Trump's eyes had been closed for quite a while, but a brief expression of what appeared to be pleasure crossed over his face as Cohen describes Trump stiffing him on his end-of-year bonus payment in 2016. A flicker of what can only be described as pleasure, or what seems to be presidential or felonious contentedness. We are so compelled. Trump is the most interesting person on the planet, and I am going to say in the history of my life, oh, I don't want to admit it. You will never admit it, but think about it. Think about the, what economists call the revealed preference. Who do you talk about the most? On Mother's Day, a joyous time, we got together, the in-laws, my parents, all together. And then my mom says, hey, did you hear how Trump said vegan? And I looked it up and he said it and it was funny. And Jimmy Fallon played the clip.
We're honored to be joined today by Shanna Gray, who owns a vegan restaurant. It's supposed to be really good. I'm not into the vegan stuff, I must say, but I'm going to have to try this. When we come here in a short period of time into Milwaukee, we're going to come and try that vegan food. I don't know if I'm going to like it.
And then I said, oh, did you see that Trump spoke and brought onto the stage former New York Giants Lawrence Taylor and Otis Anderson? And my father-in-law, maybe trying to change the subject because he's a Giants fan. Oh, did you see what he said praising Hannibal Lecter?
Silence of the Lambs. Has anyone ever seen a Silence of the Lambs? The late, great Hannibal Lecter is a wonderful man. He oftentimes would have a friend for dinner.
And I had not seen any of those, and no one in the room had seen any of the clips that weren't the one that they raised. But they were all in the category of tales of Trump. Think about it. These were all sentences from the same speech, I believe. But we all picked out different parts to share with the circle. It's like how residents of a small town would get together in the general store and talk about the local legend. I hear he done lift a dozen oxen with his bare hands. Well, I hear he felled the old Klosterman oak with one mighty swing of his hatchet. Or my dad would come home and he'd tell tales of this one strange coworker, and we'd all clamor for it. Oh, what about Jimmy the stupid security guard? Tell us about Jimmy the idiot security guard. And he'd say, well, Jimmy said, well, I can't let in any Chevys. And I said, but it's a Malibu. And he let me in. He didn't know a Malibu was a Chevy. And we all laughed. And I was like, nine, I didn't know a Malibu was a Chevy. But, you know, you just can't believe it. It's a joyousness. And it's the same with Trump, even if it's horrible. He had his eyes closed. Here's the MSNBC anchor describing that Hannibal Lecter bit.
Unlike previous occasions, Trump lauded the serial killer, a cannibal, mind you, while talking to that crowd in New Jersey.
A cannibal, mind you, but also a fictional character, mind you, sir. It doesn't matter. It's all tales of Trump. The writer Greil Marcus argued that every society concocts a figure, a perfect embodiment of the id, dreams, and values of that society. And he said this in praise of an explanation of Elvis Presley. To Greil Marcus, Elvis Presley was our embodiment. Come on, it's Trump. It is so clearly and horrifically Trump. He is an attention magnet. I ask and I wonder, has that Greil Marcus, Marcusonian figure, has that figure ever both perfectly encaptured but also damned the society? He's both our T-Rex and our asteroid hurtling towards us. And no matter how much she wants to delay it, Judge Eileen Cannon can do nothing about that. Trump, long may he serve in a minimal security prison, but we can't look away. Though you really wish you and his voters would. On the show today, white people and lifespans. But first, Sarah McCammon is a national political correspondent at NPR, where she co-hosts the NPR Politics podcast. Now, Sarah was raised in the evangelical Christian faith community. And so, for instance, speaking in tongues, that was something to aspire to. It's more than a belief system. It's an overwhelming and overriding worldview, and Sarah now views it from the perspective of someone who has exited. I'm going to talk to her about how it all fits together and her new book, Exvangelicals. Sarah McCammon, up next. Thirty-five years ago, a young Sarah McCammon was living in Kansas City, Missouri, going to her suburban church, not being able to play with Smurfs. On the weekends, she and her family would not only go to church and not only go to Sunday school, which sometimes could be fun. They had puppets, but other times would tell them all about hell. There were occasional forays into clinics that would help women or convince women not to have abortions. And then Sarah McCammon went on to an evangelical Christian college, but she knew she always wanted to be a journalist. Today, she is a journalist. She works and covers politics for National Public Radio. She's the co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. And her evangelical upbringing, well, it's hinted at greatly in even the title of her new book, The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Sarah McCammon, welcome to The Gist.
Oh, thanks so much, Mike. And you flatter me. I was a teenager 30 years ago, but I was not a little kid 30 years ago, as much as I wish that were true.
Well, tell me about going to church and going to Sunday school and what you were taught and how you were taught.
Yeah, we went to this. So I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri. But if you've ever been to Kansas City, it's like there's a Kansas side and a Missouri side. And we went to church in the Kansas suburbs. We would drive to be at this particular church, which was kind of like an early mega church, you know? This was when I was a little kid in the 80s. It was just this great big auditorium with a worship band and songs up on the overhead projector, much like what you would see, you know, more and more of in the 90s, and certainly see a lot of churches like this today. We did not affiliate with any specific denomination, so we weren't Baptist, we weren't Presbyterian, whatever. We were just a church that some people had started, and we were of the sort of charismatic tradition, which means people raise their hands, they speak in tongues, they believe in direct healing from God. It's not just like, I'll pray for you when you're sick, but like maybe God will literally grow a new liver for you, like someone mm-hmm. in my church said to someone I knew who was sick once. And so there was this very like emotional, experiential kind of version of evangelicalism. And like most evangelicals, we had this really strong belief in the importance of a personal conversion experience. You know, you had to pray this prayer, believe in Jesus, and then you had to spread that word to everybody else. And everything at church was kind of focused on that, all the sermons, all the songs. And it was fun sometimes. You know, there's sort of a feeling when you stand in a worship service full of people singing songs all together. Like, it's this very warm, exciting kind of, you know, endorphin-generating feeling. And, you know, there were times I liked that, although sometimes I felt a little pressure to, you know, be really demonstrative and that, you know, with hands in the air and eyes closed and all that. And that always felt uncomfortable for me, even as a young kid, for some reason. So maybe I wasn't cut out for that tradition.
Did you ever speak in tongues? Did you ever?
Oh, I tried. Like, so I was taught that speaking in tongues was sort of, it was a spiritual gift, right? And it was something that a believer in Jesus could ask God for. And it was a way of sort of like, you know, it was almost like leveling up, I guess, not to be casual about it, yeah. But like it was sort of like a, you know, taking the next step. And I wanted that. And I remember praying, you know, that God would give me the gift of tongues. And, you know, it didn't happen. This is like the whole, maybe this is the whole reason I'm bad at being super religious in like the ways some people are able to be. I just, if I'm not sure that I'm doing it right or it's the real thing, I just have a hard time doing it.
And it's sort of an analogy for much of the rest of your relationship with the church. You're a little up in your head. Maybe mm-hmm. some other people honestly believe they're doing it and the spirit overcomes them or whatever. They convince themselves that it's happening. Was your family noticing this? Were your parents among your brothers and sisters saying, oh, Sarah, she's that little skeptic. She's that Lisa Simpson type. We're going to have a problem on our hands with her.
You know, I mean, as much as I was struggling with it, I was so like earnest, like I really wanted to be in the club. And, you know, I was trying so hard and I was, you know, I was reading my Bible and I was, you know, making notes in the margins of my neon youth walk Bible. And I talk in the book about my little purple lavender Bible, like I wrote in there, you know, the date I was baptized and the date I was saved and all that stuff. And so I don't think they suspected. I don't know if they suspected too much. Like, I was a really good, well-behaved kid, but I was, like, never the kid that got there's this award at my Christian school called the Christian Character Award. Like, I would get the academic mm-hmm. awards, but I would not get the Christian Character Award because it was, like, I did all the schoolwork, but I guess I didn't exhibit. It wasn't like I was a bad kid, but I, like, didn't exhibit that extra level of good Christianiness.
Yeah. So I do want to take us to a little more to the present, but I'll orient the listeners by saying that Sarah went to an evangelical college that I don't think exists anymore, offering undergraduate education.
Yeah,
is that right?
Not really. It went fully online a couple years ago, and I think it's pretty much gone now. There's still a seminary, though.
Oh, God, really kills homecoming. And she was a Senate page in high school, and she went to a secular school then. And she also credits a number of her teachers, even at that college, as either agreeing with her or fostering her curiosity. And there is this evolution away, and this is what the book is about, but eventual evolution away from evangelicalism to becoming an ex-evangelical. But my question for you is, do you think the main, and the book is all about the specifics of that, but do you think the main thing driving your separation, your quest, was rooted in your intellect, your personality, or your specific experiences?
Well, I think it was all of the above, right? I mean, my experiences informed my emotions and the development of my personality. And I think they also maybe shaped the questions that I asked with my intellect. You know, I talk a lot in the book about my gay grandfather, who was the object of our concern and who'd come out, you know, in the 80s when I was a little kid after my grandmother passed away. And, you know, I talk about how that created all of this tension in my family. You know, this was right at the time when the religious right was really mobilizing. My parents were deeply involved in, you know, both conservative evangelical theology, but also politics. And he kind of stood for the opposite of everything I was being taught. So we prayed for him. You know, I mean, we believed he was going to hell, and, you know, not just because he was gay, although that wouldn't have helped, I guess. But, you know, so we had this kind of strange, distant, strained relationship with him. And that was like a big feature of my childhood in many ways. You know, every holiday, I felt that tension and that pressure to convert him and that concern for his soul. And we thought about it a lot, even when we didn't see him. And, you know, I think the existence of someone like that in my life was kind of created this like built-in foil for everything I was being told. So I don't know if that's experience or if that's emotion or if it's intellect. I think it's all of the above. And I really think for many of the people I interviewed for the ex-evangelicals, it's the same. I mean, it's you have some experience that affects the way you feel and it affects the way you see the world and it forces you to sort of rethink things with your brain, but also with your heart.
Yeah, it certainly is a combination. But I'll tell you, as I read the book, and I know the kind of person I am, and I was thinking, well, she's a journalist. There's a lot in the book about how you're always drawn to journalism. You practice, and we could hear this if we listen to the politics podcast, you're reporting, you practice a really open-minded, curious form of journalism. And I think it kind of overlapped with how I view the world. And I said, yeah. That kind of person with that orientation will have a very hard time existing in this kind of structure. And now, maybe if I was someone with a gay grandfather, I'd read it and have a different view. You know, it's very hard to square that with what they were teaching her in her actual household. But that's what I was thinking, that it's I don't see how someone who questioned the world so much could comfortably stay in the church.
Yeah. So does it strike you as more of an intellectual brain quest than an emotional heart and personality thing as you read it? I'm just curious.
This good question. So I think that everyone, so many of the people you interview have this formative experience that smacks them in the face and it's this is the time for choosing. But I didn't see you have that, right? I saw a lot of gradual things, mm-hmm. but these gradual things to the mind of a different kind of person would have been, you know, folded in or answered or not even questioned. Hmm. And then as far as the personality, from your own description, you were the good girl who wasn't rebellious, who wanted to please everyone. So it wasn't that. I think it's more the intellectual. This is just my reading of the book and my listening to your shows and my talking to you here. This was what I'm concluding. I don't know if you think that I'm missing things or don't know of some things that, you know, you withheld.
No, I actually think about this and wonder about it because sometimes something that evangelicals accuse people like me of is being overly guided by our emotions. You know, like you just want to be cool and accepted by your gay friends or something. And, you know, I also think that like yeah. having compassion and having empathy for and a willingness to listen to the fact that like most gay people I've been close to have told me that they knew this to be true about themselves from a very young age. It's not like something that, you know, much like I didn't go out and decide to walk away from my childhood faith because I wanted to upset someone. They didn't decide to be gay because they wanted to upset people. It's just who they are. And, you know, you hear that enough times from enough people, and it really challenges this idea that, like, it's something wrong that has to be changed or even can be changed. You know, and there's a lot of science, as we know, that says that's the case. And so it's things like that. I think it's actually kind of unfair to reduce them to quote-unquote emotionalism, but sometimes they are. And I, you know, there's a mm-hmm. lot of intellectual stuff out there that I could have gone into. Like, I didn't go in any detail into, like, biblical criticism. I mean, I think I referenced it, but, like, you know, there are books and books and books you can read about that or about the history of the church. I didn't go into any of that because that's not the purpose of this book. I certainly did a lot of that reading myself, and I know a lot of people do as part of their deconstruction process, as they call it. But yeah, it's just something I've wondered about. Like, is this an emotional process or an intellectual one? And does it matter, you know? Does it really matter which one it is?
So if good Christian parents, good evangelical parents want to keep their daughters from leaving the faith, what should they do?
Well, I guess I'll answer this the way that I've answered the question of what I hope evangelicals in general will take away from this, which is I hope some insight and compassion and an understanding of the fact that, again, this I don't think for most people this is about wanting to poke a finger in the eye or upset the powers that be or, you know, quote unquote, sin. You know, I mean, I really try to take people at face value unless they give me a reason not to and sort of believe people's self-report. And so when people like me say, look, I made this change because I had to, because for all these reasons I've described, it didn't make sense to me, it didn't seem right to me. It would be really helpful if people who are still in that world would at least say, okay, you know, I see it differently. It means something else for me. But I'm not going to question your experience. I'm not trying to tell anybody what to think or what to believe, but I do hope that people will accept my story and the stories of other people who are, you know, genuinely sharing them and genuinely trying to get things right the best that we can.
What's your relationship with your family today?
You know, the answer depends on the individual. I have a good-sized family, and I have relationships with all of them. My phone is full of multiple family threads and sub-threads and side threads. And thankfully, there's not a single person that I don't communicate with. But I communicate with them all differently depending on the relationship. And, you know, some members of my family I'm more aligned with, and others not at all. But I do, you know, having grown up with a tremendous amount of tension between my parents and my grandfather, and really limited access to him because of his sexuality and because of the concerns my parents had about that. I've never wanted to be estranged from my family. I encourage my kids to have a relationship with their grandparents of whatever type they want. And it's challenging sometimes, it's challenging often, but I think the older I get, the better I get, the more comfortable I get saying, you know, that's not something I want to talk about right now with you. I just, with all due respect, I don't think that would be a good conversation for our relationship. And that, like, it's taken me a long time to feel like I didn't have to defend myself or explain myself.
Have any of them read the book and gotten back to you with interesting feedback?
So I've tried to protect my family's privacy by, like, not saying more than they want me to say. But I'll say this. I do talk about my parents quite a bit in the book. It was impossible to talk about my childhood without talking about them. And I, last summer, sent them several significant sections of the book, basically the parts that were hardest on them, because I wanted them to be aware and I wanted them to have a chance to give me feedback and respond if they wanted to. They didn't want to respond on the record, but they did give me quite a bit of feedback, and we had some difficult exchanges because of that. I made some changes in response, but I will say their feedback didn't materially dispute any of the facts. It was more nuance and framing. And, you know, so in a few cases, I tried to adjust things a little bit in ways that would work for both of us. But, you know, I had thought hard about the things I shared and the things I didn't share. And I shared the things that I felt were most significant in my decision to move away from that tradition. And so, you know, I said, I'm not doing this to hurt you. I'm doing this because it's necessary for me to tell this story. My siblings, a couple of them have read it, and I think have been very kind about it. And I think one of them hasn't read it, but hasn't really commented on it one way or another. Again, this goes back to having boundaries around things, and sometimes there are certain things we just don't talk about if it's going to be a problem, which is fine with me, and I appreciate that. I'd much rather politely avoid certain subjects than fight to no good end. You know, and I had, like, my aunt read the manuscript, and then I think she also read the book just to kind of give me feedback, make sure I was getting my grandpa right. And everybody seemed to say I was getting my grandpa right. So, right. You know, I will say one more thing about that. And I was in a pretty serious car wreck in September, after I'd had this exchange with my parents about the book. And fortunately, I'm mostly okay, and things are good overall. But my parents were wonderful and really, really supportive. And they came out a few weeks later, spent a couple days with us, were very, very kind. And we had really one of the best visits we've ever had in my adult life. And I don't know how much of that was because of hashing out some things due to the book a few months earlier, and how much of it was because this was a, you know, a scary, traumatic thing that tends to bring people together. But yeah. Regardless, I was really grateful for that. And I think the older I get, the longer I am a parent myself, the more compassion I have for the fact that, gosh, everybody is just trying to figure it out. And while there are things about my childhood that were painful and that I have chosen to do differently as a parent, I also do have that compassion for my own parents. And you know, yeah. I think that's something that comes with age.
So if you have a couple more minutes, I'd love to ask you some more kind of bonus questions about politics and what you learned as a political reporter and how you apply some of the things you read about in the book to politics today. Do you have that time?
Yeah.
Okay. So we will do that in part two of the interview. But for those not joining us in our Pesca Plus segment, I want to thank you. Sarah McCammon is author of The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She is the national political correspondent for NPR, where I'm sure you hear her, as well as on the NPR Politics podcast, heating up once again. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And now the spiel. I've been doing a lot of research, and this research is out in a new Substack post that I have. And it's about longevity and lifespan, life expectancy in the United States and race. You know, on this show, I've been talking a lot about NPR, and I did a segment, and I also had a Substack post, Pesca Profundities, should you care to subscribe for free or even not for free. I had a Substack post about how often the words and phrase white supremacy was used on NPR. There was a big spike in 2020, and I played a segment from a show I did, a Illinois Public Radio show, and that was specifically about NPR. In this Substack report, I've been doing some deep dives that are more suitable to the page and data and stats than the radio. But I came across, actually I'd known this, but I found a way to present this to the audience because it's a little dangerous and a little bit dicey, but I think it is true. So therefore, even dangerous and dicey should be expressed. So to orient you, I'm going to ask you to join me in a question. There are no wrong answers, except there's totally a right and wrong answer. But it's this. And I put this to certain people to get a gauge on what people think the situation is, and then I tell them what the situation is about race and longevity and life expectancy in the United States. So let's talk about some of the ethnicities of Americans, and we will include white, black, Hispanic, Native American, Asian. Let's take those five ethnicities. And now I want you to rank them all in your mind, or if you're playing along with scratch paper, great way to listen to the gist, rank them all, rank the ethnicities. And they are, again, from who lives the longest to who has the shortest lifespans, the ethnicities being white, black, Hispanic, Asian, and Native American. So I'll tell you what 9 out of 10 people who I talked to of different ethnicities said. They said, and I think this actually, the reason they might have said this is it correlates to income, but the longest lived were Asians, then whites, then Hispanics, then blacks, then Native Americans. And now, whatever your ranking is of those five ethnicities, mentally, or if you have scratch paper, draw the line, the arrow, where you would put the lifespan of the average American. So does the average American live longer than the average Hispanic American? Does the average American live a shorter lifespan than the average white American, a longer lifespan than the average white American? And now I'll give you the answer. And this, by the way, this is why I do it all on a Substack chart, right? Graphs, lines, five lines. What the hell are you talking about? So here we go. Here is the actual rankings. The average Asian, and I shouldn't say the average Asian, how life expectancy works is an Asian American born today should expect to live over 80 years, 82 years. Next up is Hispanic, about 80 years. Then white people, 77, 78, depending on the years. Then about a 4-year drop to black people. And then actually with a lifespan under 70 years are Native Americans. Asian, Hispanic, white, black, Native American. That line, the average line, however, largely because white Americans are 60 or somewhat over 60% of the American population. That line is very, very close to the white line, precisely the average line. But in eight of the last 10 years, that light bumps along and touches the line for white Americans. But the average line is higher or the same in 8 of the last 10 years. And this is according to KFF, which used to be Kaiser Family Foundation, and their study and data on lifespan. So starting in 2019, because the pandemic did have weird effects that we're just getting out of. So starting in 2019, the average lifespan of all Americans, 78.8, and the average lifespan of white Americans, 78.8. But a year before that, 78.7 for all Americans, 78.6 for whites. Same deal the year before that, 78.6 for all Americans, 78.5 for white Americans. So like I said, in 8 of the last 10 years, including 2022, Kaiser Family Foundation, shouldn't say it, just KFF, not to be confused with KFC, they say that the average lifespan for all Americans born in 2022 is 77.5. Average lifespan for non-Hispanic white Americans, 77.5. But it is the fact, or has been the fact, and this was sort of a blew my mind a little bit fact for two reasons, that white people over the last decade have been living shorter lives, or can expect to live shorter lives, than people of color in the United States. And this got me back to the idea of white supremacy. And in my Substack, I quote many examples of people. Ibram X. Kendi does this a number of times. The greatest privilege, the greatest white privilege is life. Life expectancy is longer for white people, but it's just not true. Life expectancy is and has been for most of our very recent past has been higher for people of color. It's interesting. Why? Well, you could see it in some of the statistics. Asian people live a lot longer. Hispanic people don't realize this. Hispanic people live significantly longer than white people. Why? Well, a lot of it is the migrant effect. Migrants who come over, people who emigrate to America and become citizens, are much healthier than native-born Hispanics. There's something caustic or toxic in being a native-born. It brings down health. And then, because we're talking about relative life expectancies and things like privilege and supremacy, whites have been hit very hard with things like opioids and the drink, not great for the whites. I never find it a cause to celebrate when the black and white gap narrows just because white people live shorter. That's never a good thing. And yet that has been more or less the case for a few recent years. So it blew my mind that this was the case. If you go to England, they're very forthright about this. They don't have the same fraught history. We're not brought there in chains. This has a gigantic effect on everything that relates to the descendants of those people. And I think, you know, my theory is we do have huge racial disparities and we do have systemic racism in the United States. I don't think you could possibly argue with that. And even though systemic racism is kind of a newfangled phrase, it has a different meaning from other newfangled phrases like white privilege or white supremacy, meaning not neo-Nazis, but just the general benefit of being a white person in our society, that concept of white supremacy. Systemic racism is the racism that is opposed to personal, interpersonal racism, bigotry, and the like. There are systems which certainly perpetuate racial disparities and disproportionate impacts on the people who are descendants of, say, slaves or Native Americans, the indigenous, who were subjugated in a much different way than Asians or Hispanics, who, when they came here as immigrants, at least came here by their own volition as immigrants. So it says to me that America is still, or this is proof that America is a welcoming-ish country to immigrants, or at least as good for its immigrants as it is for its natives, which is not great compared to, say, the Netherlands or even Canada. But it really makes me question, and this is the purpose of my post, question white supremacy as it relates to longevity. But the other purpose of my post was media criticism. And I concentrated a lot on NPR. But if it's surprising to you that people of color outlive white people, if you take out of it the skewed results of the pandemic, which, by the way, white people died at a higher proportion than black and Hispanic people during the pandemic. I made that point on the show and in previous posts. But if you didn't realize that it was the case that people of color outliving white people. You got to ask yourself why. And I do think that those who are in charge of bringing us information, i.e. the media, I hate to be the blame the media guy, but the media haven't done a good job. To me, this is a fascinating result. And I don't know why they wouldn't be eager to convey fascinating results. And I hate to conclude that it complicates or distorts an agenda. I don't even know that most people in the media have a conscious agenda. I do think you get into the media to do things like raise issues about the underclass or about the afflicted. And if your story becomes, oh, white people are now getting somewhat outlived by minorities, I don't know, that doesn't fit exactly into a afflict the comfortable, comfort the afflicted ethos. And I do have to say, as a final note, I was very nervous. I've been contemplating this information for over a year now, and I'm very nervous putting it out there. I want to get it perfectly right. I'm not eager to face the inevitable charges that will come from pointing out information like this. And I also didn't want the Post to be larded with all these to be sure's, and don't you know about the migrant effect, and don't you know about the protective aspects of coming here as an immigrant? Yes, I know all that, but if you have a Post that could be 1,000 words, but it becomes 2,000 because you're trying to anticipate every rebuttal of a critic, it becomes a much less readable Post. So I thought I'd say it to you, to my audience, who is more open to the sort of free inquiry that I'm trying to pursue on Substack. And good news. I would say good news, Asians. You're doing great. And where Black and the American Indian, it's AIAN, which is American Indian Alaskan Native. That's the census designation. The status, the health status, the lifespan status of those two populations is an American shame. It absolutely is. And we should absolutely be doing everything to get resources, which includes everything from medical care to grocery stores to lessons and opportunities for greater health. This all needs to be done. But I also do think there have been a couple of these catchphrases, these buzzwords, these easily grasped accusations that are wrapped up in social critique that aren't doing it, that aren't the best way forward, because they warp the actual facts and statistics to suit a narrative. And so therefore, in Substack and podcast form, I exist to perhaps counter that narrative and take whatever incoming may result. Should you wish to comment on any of my charts in chart form or written form, go to thegist@mikepesca.com. Thank you for your indulgence. That's it for today's show. The show is produced by the Quaint Mallards. Corey Warr is the producer and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca spearheads special projects for us at Peachfish. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Mupru, Jipru, Dupru, and thanks for listening.